Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
It's midday at the movies. When Academy Awards voters bestow the Best Picture honor to Green Book, the Twitter sphere turned red in fury. Peter Jackson's new documentary about World War I gives new meaning to the word colorful, and A Star is born again. Anne Hornaday of The Washington Post and Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, join me. Plus, J. Wynn Russick reviews Frankenstein at the Cohesion Theater. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Midday's on the way after the news. I'm clicking that donut link myself. Thank you, Andy, and thanks to everybody who's stepped up and helped us out in our spring membership campaign. This is, as Andy says, the last day, and we're so grateful to everybody who has made a contribution. It is midday at the movies. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later, J. Wynn Russick, our theater critic, is going to review a production of Frankenstein at the Cohesion Theater. If you happen to be a mad scientist working in your laboratory today, creating a new human life form, I can only recommend equal dollops of Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday with a little sprinkle of Midday's director and engineer Luke Spicknell. If you do that, I think you're going to have yourself one fabulous human being. Because, yeah? I mean, separately, they're terrific. I mean, an amalgam of Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday would just be an exquisite human being. Jed Dietz, of course, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Anne Hornaday, film critic for The Washington Post. Good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So the Oscars.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Is it morning already?
Really? It is. Oh, so this Lord. Green Book thing, I mean, people went nuts. And Anne, you wrote about this a couple times. You know, I will admit, I did not watch the Oscars.
You have a life. I have a little thing we like to call a life.
I have a pathetic life, and I just didn't. It didn't include the Oscars this year. But, you know, the controversy, the reactions were immediate, and they were nasty. I mean, the New York Times. I love this actual comment. Aisha Harris tweets, congratulations to Driving Miss Daisy for being the first movie to win Best Picture twice. Mm. I mean, people were trashing this movie left and right. It was a popular movie, but what do you think, Anne? What do we make of the selection, the winning of Green Book and the reaction to the winning of Green Book?
Let's talk about the winning of Green Book. Green Book winning Best Picture, you know, coming in, there were no clear front runners, but if there, the only one that might have been a front runner was Roma, the Alfonso Cuarón movie, which had some strikes against it. It's a Netflix movie. Some people thought people wouldn't vote for it because they wanted to send Netflix a message. It's not narrative. It's not a linear, you know, classic three-act structure. It's black and white. It's very observational. It's
foreign
in
language.
Spanish and mixed text.
So you thought that Roma was the sort of the only, the distant second, not Black Panther or Spike Lee, Black Klansman?
Everybody had, all of those had sort of dings against them in terms of a best picture. Like there were people that probably loved Black Panther but didn't think a comic book movie necessarily deserved the highest honor in the Academy. Green Book follows the template for so many movies that get that award, which is it's about the story. Often when I've talked to Academy voters, what they'll say is they vote for the movie that sucked them in. They vote for the movie that moved them, that just got them and delivered. And they are still very conventional in terms of wanting that classical three-act narrative. This is a narrative that it's very familiar. And I think that more than anything else, I think it was those formal qualities that appealed to people more than you know, it wasn't a referendum on race or, you know, particular narratives or points of view as much as that.
So just strategic, I mean, you know, the voting is done by ranking. You rank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
And they sort of go through it until they find somebody who gets more than half.
Right. And you get points as you know, it's that kind of a voting system, not the one-off.
It's preferential ballot, yeah.
Yeah.
And so you don't just vote for one movie.
Right.
You don't say, here's my vote.
Correct.
You say, here's my first choice, second choice, and third choice. So it's possible that a second and third choice can, if there's enough of them, can rise to the
top. Right. And that's why a movie like this, it's liked and loved, but it's not hated by many.
Right.
And it's when you get those polarizing movies, like maybe, you know, Black Panther, polarizing just because it's a comic book movie, or Roma just because it's a Netflix movie. Like that might have dragged those averages down for those titles. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, do you think the ranked voting, and there are some jurisdictions, like in Maine, that's how you vote for your congresspeople.
Yep. I think it muddies the water. I mean, we've just described how it could. I think Green Book, and just to, you know, it's open now, huge in China. It's had this explosive opening in China. Alibaba, Jack Ma's company, was a funder and is doing movie funding. But I think it also has this appeal. I think what Anne was saying, I think is you're seeing in China also. I think as pure as a piece of art, I think it shouldn't have been nominated in either of the two categories it won in. And I'm not dissing the movie. I enjoyed the movie. And I thought the two performances are phenomenal. And I was I didn't know anything about Don Shirley's story. So I was fascinated to learn it. But I think it is retrograde in the sense that it's from a
And we should, by the way, remind folks that Mahershala Ali won Best Supporting Actor for his portrayal of the jazz pianist Don Shirley.
Yeah, a great actor who was in House of Cards, so spent a lot of time in Baltimore, too. But I think it was, you know, on the pure art form, I think the nomination slot should have been filled with other titles. I mean, Anne and I, we've talked about this on air. I mean, I think in Best Picture, you got a whole bunch of movies you could have argued should have been in that category, you know, First Reformed, Eighth Grade. I could go on and on. I mean, I think there are a bunch of movies, and I think same thing in screenplay. And I do think it comes from a period in which race in America had been sort of, can't we all just get along kind of movie making, you know, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and I think it, you know, we're now facing, you know, the role of political activism and stuff, post-civil rights and how important voting rights are. And it sort of avoids all those things. And that probably is some of the genesis of this anger about it.
But it never sets out to do that.
I mean,
I don't think those analogies are entirely fair. I mean, I think it is a throwback. There's no question. It's a very old-fashioned movie.
And as you mentioned, this is the same year that Black Klansman, Beale Street Could Talk, Blind Spotting, Sorry to Bother You, The Hate You Give.
And Black Panther
all came out.
And the Hate You Give.
So, you know, when you talk about how it's big in China, it's interesting. I can understand easily the concern that people have, particularly people of color, who are saying that's what the Chinese are thinking. That's the narrative, this white savior
It's not white, but I have to take issue with the white savior ding as well. I just don't think it applies. I mean, I think it's, if you see this movie and every, you know, obviously opinions are going to differ on this, but I think there's much more mutuality in this movie and much more complex power dynamics in this movie than a strict white savior movie. I just don't think I don't think you can reduce it to that. It's a very specific story about these two guys.
And there was a backstory that Mr. Shirley's family was opposed to it. It was written by a relative, a son, I guess, of the white character, not the black character. And so that led to this, to the white savior interpretation of it. And again, I'm talking about something I don't know anything about, which I try not to do too often, but, you know, I have not seen the movie. I mean, on the upside, Luke and I are very current on our stamp collection. but I have not seen the movie.
Right.
So you can see how that feeds into it easily.
True. Everybody has a point of view. Everybody deserves to be heard. I'm not sure that I really do think people need to see it and decide for themselves in this particular instance. I don't think that the Shirley relatives necessarily have the last word on this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that telling a story from one point of view, I don't know. I mean, we need to have that conversation. If a certain perspective or point of view is invalid, then let's have that conversation. Mm-hmm. But that is his point of view. That was the story he knew best, and that's the one he told.
Yeah, fair enough. And when it comes to people seeing it, they are now seeing it in droves. This is the Green Book has gotten a post-Oscar bump.
Yeah, doubled.
That's up there with many of the some of the record-breaking post-Oscar bumps.
Yep, it's true. And this China opening for sure was helped by the Oscar win. And I totally agree with what Anne was saying. All I would say is, as the Academy, if the Academy's job is to highlight out of hundreds of films every year the very best screenplays, the very best pictures, and they have up to 10 nominations. They only chose 8. And
we should remind folks, Green Book won for best screenplay as well.
Yes.
As well as best picture. Yes. Spike Lee won for best adopted screenplay.
And everybody is, I agree with what Anne said. I just think when you look at the other nominees in both those categories and the other possibilities, I think you'd go a long way before you'd even nominate this.
But they did nominate First Reform. And I think the screenplay win, the fact that this did win for both screenplay, that tells you that the story got them. They're not as sophisticated, they're not voting for art films. They are garden variety film goers, much more like the rest of us than we think they are. They're not erudite. They're not into arcana. They want to be entertained. They want to be engaged. And often they'll go for that middle brow, safe choice, It's just,
I mean, obviously you're right. I mean, because that's what happened here.
It wasn't shocking
to me.
And
it's almost like a consensus. You write about this in the post. It's a consensus vote. It's not.
It's the ones, twos, and threes that it got.
And I think the surprise was what Anne was saying earlier. I mean, Roma had been so strong coming through the other award systems, which are completely different voting systems, different bodies voting and all that stuff, so are not really predictive, but they're looked at as predictive, that there was this expectation that Roma maybe, there's a little bit of argument about a couple other titles, but Green Book was never in that argument. So I think it shocked people in a way that, and I think Anne's right. I mean, I think the Academy is in the middle of a change because of what Anne has written about. I mean, these 1,700 to 2,000 new members in the last couple of years. You see it in the nomination process. I think that also set a context that made this a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, and your piece in the Post also made note that it wasn't as if people of color and women were absent the dais.
Oh, gosh, no.
They spent a lot of time.
It was record-breaking.
On the stage.
It was, and I think that's what made it even more jarring than the movie that's about, that's by white guys, about a white guy, and also touches on race. Like, it was just very jarring. And I think I totally understand that point of view of it just being like, really? it was a fascinating year in terms of just how people are defining movies these days, and what counts as a movie. And now already Steven Spielberg is upset that Netflix got so very close with Roma that he's going to try to change the rules at the next governor's meeting.
So this Netflix bias is a real thing.
Well,
Because they think of it as a TV thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's his point of view.
Yeah, is that point of view widely held?
No, it's not, because if in the first place,
because Amazon would be, susceptible to the same thing, right?
No, because Amazon puts its movies out in theaters before it streams them.
Sometimes.
But they've made more of a commitment to that. And
true.
But Netflix has compromised. So everybody's giving a little bit. But look, the Academy saw fit to nominate Mudbound for 4 awards last year, which was a Netflix movie. And got
which
a little
was
bit,
in theaters.
Yes,
right?
Mm-hmm. Nominal, and I think simultaneously to the streaming, which that told me they weren't nearly as anti-Netflix as we had assumed. And then this year, Roma got 10 nominations.
Mr. Spielberg notwithstanding.
Exactly. And my sense is that people, this is the future, and they may not love it, and I think they all want exhibitors to do well, and they want to retain theatrical business, but to kind of make these demarcations and distinctions isn't realistic.
I agree. In fact, I think this is the year to say to people, stream any of these movies you want to see. Go see them in a movie theater. Go see Roma. Go see, Black Panther in a movie theater and see which experience is better for you.
Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. We'll talk about more movies on the other side of a quick break. But first, we want to pause on this final day of our spring pledge drive to ask you to make a pledge and become a sustaining member of your public radio. Here's Andy Beanstock to tell you just how to do that. And welcome back to Midday at the Movies. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on Midday, we're going to examine the proposal by Johns Hopkins University to establish a private police force. It's a proposal that needs to be approved by the Maryland legislature. The Baltimore Senate delegation is voting on the proposal in about 35 minutes. We'll talk about it tomorrow with veteran Baltimore journalist and author Antero Pietola, Hopkins University political science professor Lester Spence, and investigative reporter Stephen Janis. He's with WIPR's Truth and Reconciliation podcast. Plus, a cool musical treat, the celebrated flamenco guitarist Grisha Goryachev performs for us live here in Studio A. That's ahead of his Saturday night concert at UMBC. So that's all coming up tomorrow right here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it is the March installment of Midday at the Movies. Our movie mavens, Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post, and Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, join me. You can join us, too. The number to call Midday is different than the number to call to make a pledge. We'd love for you to be one of those 15 folks helping us meet our goal. Again, the pledge number, 410-235-1395. The Midday number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. Love to hear from you about what you thought about the fact that Green Book won the Academy Award for Best Picture. So, Jed Dietz, let's talk a little bit about another movie that's getting a bit of a bump after the awards, and that's A Star is Born, because they have re-released it with the bonus minutes or something. It's like 12 minutes longer in this version, right? And will there be a bunch of people who saw it the first time who will go to see it the second time for those 12 minutes?
Well, it was only on a few screens, but I think 1,000 screens. But people did go to see it. The big bump came for the album, and both the song Shallow and the album have gone to the top of the Billboard chart again. I mean, a huge jump there. And frankly, I think it was the best few minutes of the whole Oscar broadcast.
That was amazing.
It was incredibly well staged. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I think the Academy staging
that's
music.
That's when they were as close to making out as you could possibly be without actually making out and continuing to sing a melody.
Well, it's
this is Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga.
And Bradley, according to Gaga, Bradley designed the whole thing. He directed that whole sequence. It was the best song presentation I've ever seen in an Oscars. Emotional, beautifully staged, and they rehearsed it highly. And of course, she said, you know, about all these rumors about that, you know, they're in love and all this stuff. She said, "We're actors, you know.
You're supposed to convince people you're in love.
This is what our
their day job,
right?
We actually have a clip of a new song. This is one of the new songs they wrote for the new movie,
or
I guess
Encore.
It just
it's
got
called
it.
Encore. It's called Encore.
Yeah, the Star is Born Encore. The new tune is called Clover.
Something we can both get over, oh, I'll still believe in love.
Time goes
really
by. I'll keep winning, keep losing till I die.
That's good. Well, there you go. Time keeps going by. I'll keep winning and losing till I die.
Wow.
That's
He's
profound.
So deep.
That is heavy, man. Not since Cahill Gibran have been moved like that. That's quite something. I do want to talk about an actual movie that I have seen.
What?
I'm very excited. I know.
Wait,
this
you
happens,
buried the lead.
This happens,
you went to a movie?
Exactly. I did. This
Wait
happens
a
three times a year, whether it needs to or not. And Linnell and I went and saw at the Senator Theater a real live movie theater, this incredible World War I documentary by Peter Jackson, who's the guy who's the director of like that road movie. What is it?
Lord of the Rings.
Walking and Talking Parts 1, 2, 4, and 5. Yes,
I couldn't stand that movie. It's like I felt like I was
stuck
on the Jersey Turnpike for 9 hours in that movie. But the movie that he's made, a documentary called They Shall Not Grow Old. I thought it was terrific.
Magnificent, isn't
it?
So
incredible.
Oh, yeah. That, you know, it's interesting. This sort of loops into, I think, where Spielberg is coming from. I think the anxieties that he's expressing have to do with the disappearance of a sense of occasion. And I have picked up on this with people's responses to Roma.
Yep.
people who saw it in their homes on their little screens thought, what's the big deal?
It's so true.
Those who saw it in a theater were blown away. And I feel that more and more, you know, sometimes audiences create the occasion themselves, like with RBG. That turned into almost a ritual communal experience, especially for women across generations. And they shall not grow old.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show
of
women law school graduates.
You know, I looked at it, and its business spiked over Mother's Day weekend because it was such a thing to do with your mom and your grandmother. And They Shall Not Grow Old started as that. It was these one-off events in December and January, done by Fathom, which is known for the Metropolitan Opera broadcast that they do in theaters around town. And they were sold out. They went like, they just played like gangbusters. And I just feel like it's restoring, you know, they present it with a little preamble from Peter Jackson and a postamble explaining how he did this incredible thing. And I just feel like, this is what, you know, this is the kind of event that will preserve the theatrical experience. And,
well,
and
I would
that,
argue
and
both
which is
of
what
them.
You're doing at the Parkway
Well. And we've had great success with Roma at the Parkway after it's been on Netflix.
Exactly.
It's so
exactly.
interesting. But you're so right about this. And this is also the technology that is all new coming into filmmaking being used in such an interesting way. And
so talk a little bit about that, because obviously he used audio footage, interviews with 40 or 50 World War I veterans that the BBC had recorded. And he also had film, like the kind of World War I film we're all used to seeing, the black and white film where everybody's walking a little faster than in real life. And he took that film and manipulated it in an amazing way.
Yeah, so the British Imperial War Museum had both these huge chunks of film and huge chunks of audio files from historic. The film had been highly degraded, both audio too, I guess, but the film had really been degraded. And again, I don't know, it's so important to see this at the Senator. And I don't know whether they do it with every showing, but when they have it in the big theater, they do not only the preamble with Peter, but Peter Jackson.
Yeah, there's a 30-minute postlude which Mr. Jackson explains how they did these amazing effects.
And one of the things he shows you in that is the syncing of audio and film with a speech that they found and that they had an actor read. And how you see the magic of technology bringing you arguably one of the most horrible wars ever fought on the planet, and bringing it back to life in a very human, personal way. And it could only be done through this wizardry, this technologic wizardry. And who knew Peter Jackson, you know, Lord of the Rings and, you know, huge filmmaker, had this... was a World War I nerd, and apparently he's been this
he owns all these relatives. World War I uniforms and stuff.
I think he had a family member who served.
Yeah.
He
dedicates the film to
it.
I also would highly, when we saw it with a couple of teenagers, and I cannot recommend highly enough that people bring their teens, because most of these young men in the movie are 17, 18, 19 years old, and it's to Jed's point, this is an immersive experience. He puts you right on the battlefield with these gentlemen. And one of the pieces of wizardry he did was, these were silent films. And he had forensic lip readers read the lips of these soldiers, and then he hired actors to dub in what they probably might have been saying. And it's just the most seamless experience.
And you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes into the movie, all of a sudden the black and white film turns to color.
Correct, yeah.
Which I hope is not a spoiler alert.
No, it's lovely.
It'll knock you out whenever.
Cheesy, but it's just absolutely so wonderfully
done. And so you see World
War
I footage in color, which you're not used to seeing. Yeah. And, you know, it's as if there are these, you know, distant, dispassionate people, you know, digging around in gray mud. Well, it's not gray mud. No. It's brown mud.
Right.
And it's
sinking. And too often red mud, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I can't recommend it highly enough. And this is, yet again, like last year, we saw these documentaries do so well. This is a phenomenon.
Yep.
I mean, it has already made $17 million. I mean, I hate to reduce everything to box office, but it just shows you how galvanizing it is with audiences.
If you'd said World War I restored footage is going to be a hit movie, you'd say, please, you know, and it is.
And I will say that at the screening that we attended, it was full.
Good.
Yep.
And almost nobody, maybe two people left before the 30-minute thing at the end in which Jackson explains what the techniques were. So, I mean, everybody was just riveted by the whole experience, and also the masterful film artistry of this and the technique of it. It's incredible. Let's go to the phones. We have Frank in Mount Washington calling midday. Thanks for your call, Frank. What's on your mind?
Thank you. This is the perfect time for this sequence. I'd like you to talk a little bit more, you've mentioned it, about the legitimate aspiration of filmmakers to have movies released into a theater, because the impact of film, the ability of film to create community, is most powerful when a bunch of total strangers sit in a dark room and watch it. I went to the Senator with my younger brother, Saving Private Ryan. We went to a matinee. I joked on the way in, oh boy, all these old people, we'll be able to beat them to the seats we want, ha ha ha. We watched the film, we were coming out, I was walking through the lobby, and I saw the rest of the audience, and I stopped in my tracks, and my eyes filled with tears, and I said, Jay, do you know who these people are? Mm. These people are those 17 and 18-year-olds we saw in the film. And now, for the first time, they're able to share with these women that we see, who are their wives, their daughters, their sisters, the experience that they had, because no prior war movie, Longest Day, Patton, Battle of the Bulge, was ever presented in such realism. And I think that especially in this day and age, we're trying to find common ground in society, it's important that people go to see films in a dark room where we all react the same way, and then the lights come up, and lo and behold, I never would have thought I would have felt the same way as that person or that person.
Yeah, that's a good comment, point. Frank. I appreciate that call. And I remember when Linnell and I saw Black Panther at the Senator, there was a little boy, African-American kid, who was dressed up in a superhero costume, who was 10 years old, in front of us in the popcorn line. And through the whole movie, I just kept thinking, thank God that child is here. I mean, this is such an experience for him. This is such a great thing for him to be able to see people who look like him on the screen, which is, you know, for him, unfortunately, a rare event, and for white people, a common event. So interesting. But I just think it's interesting that the movie's doing well too. I'm happy about that. And you saw a movie, another war movie. It opens on the Parkway Theater here in Baltimore in a couple of weeks, the 22nd, called Women at War.
Oh, fascinating, wonderful film. It's actually woman singular, because what a woman. This is a film from Iceland about a woman. A middle-aged woman on a quest, driven by anxieties around ecological damage, environmental damage, globalism, corporatism, and she's trying to kind of wage this quixotic fight against a utility company and the government in outside Reykjavik. But she's leading something of a double life. I don't want to give too much away, because what happens, what we discover about her and the tensions that are animating her life are really quite wonderful. It's by Benedict Erlingsson, I think the director's name is, and this actress, her name is Halldóra Geirsdóttir, and she is just a goddess. I mean, she's just this tall, lithe, athletic. She's a warrior, and also very gentle and tender and nurturing. And these two sides of her personality come into play. It's got lovely touches of absurdism. He stages scenes with the musicians providing the musical score in the scene, and they're kind of commenting on the action a little bit. So there are moments of levity, but it's about a very serious subject, but I think done with such grace and swiftness and fleetness, it's really delightful.
An action movie with no CGI and one drop of blood, I think.
Yes, maybe. Yeah. Yes, exactly. It's really delightful.
Yeah. The Charles Theater opening tomorrow, a documentary about Apollo 11. Have you guys had a chance to see this?
I saw it at Sundance. This is another one. This is like the Peter Jackson movie in the sense that somebody at NASA very early on committed a lot of money to great cameras and great sound equipment. So there would be this archive available to great filmmakers like Todd Miller, who would then build a story out of this incredible national effort. And I cannot tell you strongly enough to go see this movie. This is another one.
So this is not a narrative fiction movie. This is a documentary about the Apollo.
This is NASA 11. Footage. Mm-hmm. This is all NASA footage. And it, even if you've seen First Man, this one you should see, and you must see it in the movie theater. It's incredible. Mm.
All right. Well, it's always good to see you in here. Likewise, in Studio A, and as well as at movie theaters, which, as you know, I
keep,
am very
keep
infrequent.
At it, Tom. You'll find it's really a lot of fun. And there's popcorn.
There's popcorn. I've heard
you're
that.
A very good boy.
I've heard that.
Good draft beer at the Parkway.
There you go.
You've got all kinds of reasons.
Wine in a can.
All right. And wine in a can, my Lord. Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post, the author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Quick break, and when we come back, J. Wynn Russick joins us with a review of Frankenstein, the new play at Cohesion Theater Company. But first, it's the final day of our spring pledge drive. We are so grateful to everybody who's become a member of WIPR, and if that esteemed group doesn't yet include you, here's Andy Bienstock to talk about how easy it is to join.